Welcome, everybody. This is the second office hours session for the Mises Academy class, Energy or Ventures in Energy Economics. And as usual, on these office hour sessions, for those of you who are tuned in live here, go ahead and start typing in your questions. While you guys are doing that, let me just say next week I'm going to be going to Washington, D.C. for the Institute for Energy Research Carbon Tax Conference. So if you're taking this class, you're going to be interested in energy economics, so I highly encourage that. If you missed, there's like a live stream where obviously if you're in the D.C. area, go ahead and come to it if you can. But then afterward, they're going to put it up on YouTube and everything, so obviously I'll let you guys know about that. Okay, we got some questions rolling in. Matt Miller says, and remember, everybody, if you're new to these sorts of courses, this is a free-for-all, so you can ask me whatever you want. It doesn't have to be related to the material that we're covering in this course. So Matt Miller says, in an ANCAP society, do you think it would be, quote, legal to hire a hitman? I've had this argument with friends many times. My position was yes, as hiring someone in and of itself is not an act of aggression. Obviously, the hitman himself is a murderer and would be severely punished for his aggression. What are your thoughts on that? Yeah, this is a really interesting issue. So let me just walk you through it. So the question is, okay, there's a sense in which if you're going to use, the quick answer to your question, Matt, for me is I don't think it would be legal, but let me walk through it because some people might hear that and be like, what the heck, how is that even an issue? Of course, you can't hire someone to kill somebody. But let me walk through the logic of it and so people can at least see why this is an interesting question, because if you're coming at it, at the issue from a standard Rothbardian perspective where, you know, you think through the logic of where do property rights come from, and then the job of a judge in a libertarian society is to apply those legal principles to specific cases, one might end up thinking the way you're thinking, Matt. So let's switch to something else, something like prostitution. I think 99.9% of people who call themselves libertarians and more particularly anarcho-capitalists would say, oh yeah, in a world sort of following the kind of things in which I believe, these kind of principles, clearly prostitution would be legal because you might think it's immoral. You might have strong religious objections to what is ethical or whatever. You might not want your daughter or your sister to turn to that as a way to make a living, but if people are doing it, you know, it's, and so how do you walk through the logic of that and say, well, they're not hurting anybody. It's voluntary. And you can't say it's an exchange of validly owned property, obviously assuming that the money being used to pay for it was not, you know, gotten illegally or whatever. That's a voluntary transaction, an exchange of things that the people own. You could say if a woman sleeps with somebody not for money, well, clearly no one has any, you know, that's not illegal. And then it's not illegal to give someone money. So how in the world, I'm sort of going into a George Carlin skit, if any of you have seen that, where he says the same principle except with foul language. So then how can it be illegal? If it's not illegal to sleep with somebody and it's not illegal to give them money, well, then how the heck can it be illegal to give them money to sleep with you? So that's the idea. And then you can get into things like blackmail. So that's one that is odd too. A lot of people just instinctively don't like blackmail, but when you think through the logic of it, you say, well, wait a minute. I don't own my reputation, right? I can't control the thoughts of other people. I don't have a property right in people thinking well of me. And so if somebody finds out that, you know, I'm doing something I shouldn't be, like if I'm the pastor of a church and someone finds out that I'm having an affair, then, you know, and the person comes up to me and says, I have this incriminating evidence that you're having an affair, and you would be ruined professionally if I publicize this to your congregation. So pay me $1,000 a month and I'll keep this quiet. So right now that's illegal in most countries to do that. But I think most libertarians, certainly Walter Block, would argue that shouldn't be illegal, that that's really not a crime. It might be immoral. You might think the guy's a jerk for doing that, but should it be illegal to do that? Again, assuming that he came by the information in a legal way, right? I mean, like if he broke into your house and snuck into your room and, you know, bugged your phone or something, you could argue that's illegal, you know, that that should be a crime, but it's the breaking into the house and bugging your phone that's the crime. It's not saying I have some information, I could divulge that information to a bunch of people and that would embarrass you and hurt you professionally unless you pay me. Because the point is, Walter Block's point is to say the blackmailer, though you may think he's morally reprehensible, how is he doing something illegal? He owns his body. He can go and talk to people and tell them information, or if he has photographs that he legally owns, how can you, you know, he has the right to go hand those photos out, those embarrassing photos that, you know, catch the guy in having an affair. He can go hand those out to people, but that's not a crime. And so then the point is, how can it be a crime for him to go to the guy who's in the photos and say, if you give me money, I will refrain from handing these photos out to people. How can that possibly be a crime? Okay, so I just walked through two standard examples where most libertarians would agree that, yeah, that shouldn't be a crime. And you see the procedure there is we started out with things that we all agree are validly owned property and then realized that the behavior or the action that is typically in modern legal systems made illegal is just people voluntarily exchanging what we think of as should be their valid property titles. So then how can that be a crime in a libertarian or an anarcho-capitalist society? By the way, I'm kind of, in these remarks right here, using libertarian and anarcho-capitalist interchangeably. Strictly speaking, those are distinct terms, but, you know, I'm just trying to answer Matt's question here without getting too nitpicky. Okay, so now back to Matt's question. Using that sort of framework by which we said, hey, in a libertarian world, even though in the present legal system in most countries, prostitution and blackmail are illegal, they shouldn't be. By the same token, couldn't somebody argue hiring a hitman should not be a crime? And so you know, think through the logic of it, that when you hire a hitman, what are you doing? You are giving him money. And the point is it can't be a crime to give somebody money. And then the issue is, but wait a minute, but here where there's something clearly different from the others is that the hitman is then going and doing something that clearly is a crime, namely murdering somebody. And so, so the position of people who say the hiring of the hitman per se should not be a crime is to say, oh yeah, we're not saying the hitman should be exonerated. Obviously, if he goes and kills somebody, not in self-defense, you know, just goes out and murders somebody, then he should be punished with the law. You know, that's a crime. But the question is the guy who paid him money, is that guy a criminal also? And so, there is a case to be made that, well, no, how could it be? You know, it's not a crime to give someone a piece of gold. And so what if the reason you're giving them the gold is to go do something illegal? That's not forcing the hitman to go do anything illegal. It's ultimately the moral and legal responsibility for it falls on or at least the legal responsibility, you could argue the morality, falls on the hitman. So that's the claim. So like I say, Matt, I understand the logic of it, and I used to be intrigued by that when I was younger and kind of walked through it, and for a while I believed that myself. And now I don't, and my objections are twofold. So one thing is I no longer believe that you can deduce the whole body of law in a libertarian world just thinking through the implications of various axioms. All right, so I think instead what it's just more I picture judges having cases brought before them and they make decisions and there's a market for that and based on the norms in the community, certain judges will rise to prominence and other ones won't. And that's going to happen no matter what. And that's just a positive description of what a free market and legal rulings would look like. And I'm not sure that the way you figure out what the right thing to do is to try to come up with deductions from first principle. I could be wrong about that. I'm not as sure, but what I'm saying is I'm not as confident now as I would have been when I was 25 that the way we should answer questions like this is just sort of like think it through rationally and see, well, what would the answer have to be? All right. So that approach can be illuminating in certain cases. And I do think that it helps with blackmail and things like that. But to give an example where I think it kind of does lead you astray, the stuff with children. And I think there are, you could kind of say, again, using that same logic, well, if I have a kid and I have a toddler who's sitting in his high chair and I just watch him starve to death, or maybe not even a toddler, a small, like an infant, just sitting in the high chair propped up and I just watch him starve to death, I didn't kill the kid, right? I didn't, if the kid wanted to leave the house and go get a job and feed himself, I wouldn't have stood in his way. But he did. He just sat there and starved to death. That's not my fault. Right. So there's a sense in which you could argue that from a strict libertarian property rights point of view. And I don't think that would be true. I think even in a libertarian society that it would be illegal to do that. So I don't know what the solution would be. I'm not saying necessarily they would have agencies going on breaking down people's doors and taking their kids away at gunpoint. I'm just saying I am not sure that there would be no sort of positive obligation you would owe your children. Even though one could plausibly argue that just thinking it through from first principles. So then the same thing with hiring the hitman, even if we did agree that technically there is no issue that, how can it be a crime to hand someone over money? I'm just going to say, well, I think the judge could say plausibly, well, because he's hiring to kill someone, that kind of is an extenuating circumstance. And so that's why. That's a crime. And then if the judge ruled he was guilty, I think that would survive. And it's not like that judge would go out of business in a libertarian society. The other thing is, even on its own terms, even if you don't like what I just said and you say, no, I really do think the way legal decisions ought to be made in a good society is we have a common core of like principles by which we deduce property rights. And then the judge's job is just to apply those principles to certain cases. It's still not clear to me now, even though it seemed obvious to me when I was in my 20s, that hiring someone to do something criminal is per se not a crime itself. That I don't see how you, whereas going back to like the prostitution example, where people agree it shouldn't be a crime, well, not everybody, like in Muslim society, they wouldn't agree, but most people in Christian or agnostic societies agree that just sleeping with somebody for free should not be criminal. And then the issue, and then, so then it's like, well, then how can paying for it turn it into a crime? It's with hiring a hitman, it's not obvious to me that if I just said to somebody, hey, I'd really appreciate it if you went and murdered that guy over there, but I didn't give the person money to do it. And then the guy went and did it, it's not obvious to me that that's not a crime also. And so you don't have the same analogy of being able to say, the transfer of money should not be turning something illegal that previously wasn't illegal. So Matt, if you want to come back and reiterate this, I'm just saying right now, I can't even come up with what in my mind is a very compelling argument by which one might think that. But I know, well, I don't want to say the person's name in case he's not ready for this information to be divulged. I know there was a Mises Institute fellow one time who had that viewpoint, Matt, and it was, he made a very compelling case for it, but like I say, when all was said and done, I thought it was wrong. It was an interesting case. And the other thing, too, is even with a lot of this stuff, it's you could, how can I put it? The market would be very versatile and able to deal with all these kind of weird situations. And so if you're picturing a kind of society like the one I sketched out in my pamphlet Chaos Theory, where, you know, in a large society with a lot of anonymity, you know, with bustling cities with millions of people in them and people coming and going, and it's kind of, you know, a lot of strangers you encounter on a daily basis, in that kind of world, depending on the specifics, the market outcome might be that in order to get, you know, rent a car and get a job somewhere, or buy a house, or engage in major transactions, or maybe even to get into large shopping centers and things like that, you might have to be part of some larger organization that vouches for you, just as a baseline. Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I kind of think that would be the immediate thing given today's society if we instantly switch. But maybe over time, if people grew up in a society that didn't have a coercive state, maybe crime would be so rare that all this stuff wouldn't even be necessary, because it would be such a fluke if somebody actually had criminal proclivities. I don't know. But I'm just saying it's conceivable that in a world like that, you know, you would need some third-party organization vouching for you for people to be willing to, like I say, do things where they kind of need to have an idea of this person, a criminal. Like I said, you know, renting an apartment, that somebody comes up and says, hey, I'd like to live here. And a standard thing that a landlord might do is to say, okay, well, you know, who vouches for you? And it's not even that it would necessarily be like I guess it would be kind of analogous to what's currently called a background check, but there would be competing agencies. So it's not like there'd be one central computer that had tabs on everybody. It might be 1,000 different agencies keeping track of, you know, the criminal records of an official behavior and credit history of the people that pay them to do that kind of stuff. And so it's not like there's any one agency that has, you know, information on everybody. It's dispersed, so there's not too much concentrated power. But if you want to rent a car or sign a one-year lease or something, and the landlord just wants to be, you know, sure who the heck is this guy before I give him the keys to my building, and he's coming and going and rubbing shoulders with the young family down the hall that's got two little kids, you know, if this guy killed somebody three cities over, I kind of want to know that. And without a government and the FBI, how would you know? And so I'm saying it could be these agencies that's what they do. So anyway, if there were somebody who paid $100,000 to a hitman to go kill somebody, and then the guy got caught, and that guy was prosecuted by the legal system for murdering someone, but strictly speaking, the legal system was such that technically the guy merely hiring the person was not guilty of any crime per se, still his reputation would be shot, and all these agencies that would be vouching for him, and that's how he, you know, has the ability to engage in sensitive transactions and things like that require trust, well, then that could all be shut off, because that would also be voluntary also. So in other words, all the landlords could agree, I'm never letting you come and rent a room from me. And banks could all agree, we're not giving you a loan, and credit card companies could turn them off, and, you know, Disney World would say, you can't come in here because we got kids here. And you're... So the point is, there's a lot that the system could do to respond to somebody short of actually initiating, short of using coercion, defined as a violation of property rights, right? So, whereas if the guy is truly deemed legally guilty of a crime, well, then guys with guns could, in principle, you know, go grab him. Whereas you couldn't do that in the setting I'm talking about, if the law said, well, you know, the guy is a jerk and maybe he's evil, but he's technically not a criminal, still there's a lot of things that could happen. So anyway, that's kind of how I deal with that stuff. That on the one hand, it's neat to think through the logical implications of those things, but on the other hand, I mean, it's the law doesn't need to do as much work in the libertarian world as it currently does, because now it's kind of like there's all these laws against discrimination and stuff. So right now, if you're a landlord, you can't just say, you know, I didn't hire or I didn't rent my room out to that guy because he just looked kind of shady. I don't like the looks of him. Or especially you can't say that about why you didn't get someone a job. I mean, there's all kinds of various laws about non-discrimination. You have to sort of, you know, sort of give some more official reason. Whereas if there isn't a state, that kind of stuff would be permissible. Okay. George Smith says, are you familiar with Nikola Tesla's plan to provide cheap energy for the whole world? I've vaguely heard of it. And I know like a lot of people are totally into Tesla and everything, but no, I can't right now, George, I shouldn't talk about it because I don't know enough to say something intelligent. If you had a specific thing you wanted to ask me about it, you can ask and I can comment, but I can't just off the cuff start talking about it. All right. I don't know if I'm saying your name right. Jure Gubank. What if the Brazil government decides to destroy the Amazon forest in order to build cities there? The Amazon forest is necessary for world oxygen levels. Do we need to intervene? Can the free market provide oxygen and air, although there are no property rights in it and there is no incentive to take care for oxygen? The British government just got bumped, hang on. The British government destroyed their forest to build a navy. Should we prevent any more of these cases in developing countries? Well, the quick answer is, I mean, no, my natural instinct is to say, because when you say should we prevent, normally what people interpret that to mean is like, should the U.S. government stop other governments from doing things that could be bad, and that's certainly going to happen. The other governments do things that are bad, and then the issue is, you know, what is it correct? You know, first of all, is it justified from a libertarian perspective for one coercive entity to do something to stop another coercive entity? And you know, classic examples are things like the war between the states, or what's more colloquially called the Civil War in the United States, where the southern states wanted to secede, and yeah, there was certainly rights violations occurring in their territories and their jurisdiction, and so the question is, well, you know, is it justified for the northern government to come in and beat them down if they freed the slaves? Like, is that something they could have? Or right now, like, if state governments are restricting people's liberties, should libertarians applaud when the federal government comes in and says you can't do that anymore? So that stuff gets tricky. I think personally I think that's a bad idea. Just, you know, there's like a slippery slope if nothing else. But also, even in terms of strict theory, it's sort of like you're using an immoral mechanism to try to achieve a moral result. And I don't think that works. So just like, you know, it's, you can't, like, I think it would be wrong to steal money from someone to then go buy weapons so that you can go out and stop criminals, right? Because you're stealing in order to try to stop theft, and I don't think that changes if the theft you're stopping is worse than the crime you had to commit in order to get the money, to get the means to stop the larger criminal. So, in general, that's, you know, I mean, to use governments to stop stuff, I think, is not justified. Also, I mean, in terms of your more specific question, I think, I mean, for one thing, I mean, the problem is government ownership of important natural resources. So the reason, I mean, you notice what you're saying, that the Brazilian government might do this. And even if someone says, well, no, wait a minute, they're just, you know, leasing the timber land to private companies, and they're the ones coming in and cutting down the Amazon. Well, even so, even there, it's still, and we're going to get into this, we were supposed to get into it this week, and we didn't finish it, so we'll cover it in the first part of week three. Even there, strictly speaking, the problem is that there's not actual private ownership. And that's also the problem with a lot of things called strip mining and stuff like that, where you can understand why someone who doesn't understand free market economics would look at what private companies do and how they do things that are not environmentally friendly, and then come away thinking, oh yeah, they just care about money, they don't care about the environment. But really, usually what the issue is that the way the government system works, the government remains the owner and is just leasing the temporary usage of, you know, the forest land, you know, giving the private companies the right to come in and say, hey, if you pay us a certain amount of money, you can come in and cut down as many trees as you want, but we retain ownership. It's not like you own the forest. You just have the legal right now to come in and cut down trees and then leave. So if you're the private logging company and that's the arrangement, you have no incentive to preserve the asset because the government's maintaining ownership. You're just going to come in, and it's, you know, once you pay the money and you go in, the more trees you cut down, the more money you make. Whereas if what the government did was auction off the actual ownership of the forest land to private owners, private companies, then I think you'd see much more responsible stewardship of the forest. Because now if they, so it's, again, I'm sort of getting ahead of ourselves. We'll talk about this in the beginning of the lecture on week three. But it's called the tragedy of the commons, what it is. So it's the same thing that happens with overfishing. You know, you have a bunch of fish in a pond or in a river or something like that, and then the government comes in and puts in all kinds of restrictions on the season. You know, oh yeah, you can't fish during this season, and you can't have a boat that has an engine that's bigger than this, and you can only use nets of a certain size. And they have all these arbitrary constraints to try to limit the ability of the fishermen and women to catch fish, because they know if they just allow unrestricted fishing, you know, they'll get to the point where the fish are no longer self-sustaining, that their population will disappear. They'll be fished into extinction. But again, the fundamental problem there is that the river or whatever the body of water is owned by the government. And so what they're selling people is the right to come in and take as much fish as you want. And then given that system, of course, you're going to have overfishing. But if instead you literally sold the body of water to a private owner to then set the rules, it would be handled much more efficiently. So that's with the forestry. I mean, what would probably happen is, you know, what I would say is, well, privatize as much as possible. And then in those areas where there is private ownership of forest land, if it really is true that governments around the world are doing such a poor job of protecting vital resources that humanity is in danger of running out of oxygen, well, then that's going to give an incentive for entrepreneurs elsewhere to figure out, how do we make money by planting trees over here on land that we own? And so that's a tricky issue, but there's, you know, I guess what I'm saying is there's all kinds of ways to solve the problem short of having stronger governments use tax-funded militaries to go in and pressure the Brazilian government or whoever to not do it. One obvious example is people could take up a collection. I mean, if it really were the case, the Brazilian government was going to foolishly allow private companies to cut down so many trees that it ended up there wasn't enough. The atmosphere was slowly turning more and more into carbon dioxide because there wasn't enough turnover, no more trees to convert it back. Well, there's billions of people around the world who would be concerned about that, and if they all kicked in a dollar a year, well, that's billions of dollars a year they could pay the Brazilian government to not do that. Right? So I don't think it's possible that the outcome would be, oh my gosh, unless we send warplanes down there, the Brazilian government is going to do something that kills all of us, including Brazilians. See what I'm saying? So that's kind of my take on that. Okay, Lewis Menard says, Rothbard says that nobody can act as prosecutor or plaintiff except the victim. Does he address the case of children more specifically elsewhere? Because otherwise, children cannot defend themselves when they are too young to speak about the abuses they endure. Yeah, okay, that's a good question. So the issue is what Rothbard is, the context of him saying that would be in our society right now, and this goes back to, you know, in England, at some point there were certain crimes that were considered like against the king or against the ruler of the realm. And nowadays you see that in our judicial system, at least in the United States. I don't know what the nomenclature is in other countries, but it will be like the district attorney. You'll see the court case, if it's criminal, it will be like, you know, New York State versus Bob Murphy. If I've been accused of committing a murder in New York State or something, I mean, so it's like it's not the family of the person I'm accused of killing taking me to criminal court. I mean, they could take me to civil court, but in terms of criminal offenses, the way the government legal system handles it, it's that I've committed a crime against the state. And that's why it's the state who's punishing me, and then they're going to take me and put me in prison, as opposed to, if I'm found guilty, you know, giving damages to the, you know, the victim if he's still alive, or the estate of the victim if it's somebody I murdered. Okay, so Rothbard's saying that's crazy. In a libertarian world, if somebody, like, I don't know, I go up and I punch somebody in the face, and that guy's a pacifist, I'm pretty sure Rothbard would say only that guy who got punched in the face is allowed to bring charges against me. Somebody else can't come up and say, hey, Bob Murphy initiated aggression against that guy, so I'm going to sue Bob Murphy. That wouldn't make sense. The judge would say, but, you know, Murphy didn't initiate aggression against you. Okay? So, given that framework, and there's a certain obvious justice in that framework, because then it's like the person, you know, who had the wrong committed against him or her is the one who's going to get the restitution. Whereas now it's like if you kill somebody or if you go up and really hurt somebody, typically what happens is the government comes and puts you in a cage, and that doesn't per se make the person any better off. Like what if the person that I hurt would rather that I stay free and I give that person 50% of my income for the next 10 years. Right? Whereas if I'm sitting in a prison making license plates, you know, I can't really help the person. And then on top of that, what if the person has like religious views and does not believe in, you know, retribution, or does not believe in punishing wrongdoing or something, like, you know what I mean? So there's all kinds of weird issues there. So, but having said all that, what Lewis is talking about is that framework is a little bit tricky if it comes to children, because let's say, you know, you see, forget the weird cases of just child neglect. where one might argue on Rothbard's principles that technically that's not a crime. Let's say it's outright, you know, you see an adult literally punching a little kid in the face, clearly initiating aggression, is clearly a crime. But now, wait a minute, you as the bystander can't go to the courts and say, whoa, I'm going to bring charges against this guy who just punched that one-year-old in the face, because, as I just said a few minutes ago, unless the crime is against you, you have no legal standing. So Lewis is asking about that. Roth would ever address that. Well, now that I hope I did such a good job, Lewis, of setting up the context of your question, and we're all burning for the answer, my answer is, I don't remember. So, I mean, obviously it would be in the book, The Ethics of Liberty, where Rothbard, you know, walks through the structure of libertarian legal principles. So it's sort of like a blueprint for what the law would look like in a society that Rothbard would call a free society. But unfortunately, Lewis, it's been years since I've read that. At the top of my head, I don't remember what Rothbard said about that. I don't even remember if he said anything about that particular issue. Let me just say something, because it's what you for sure have the right to delegate your legal rights to third parties. So what you can do is, you know, even if, you know, you can, of course, go hire a lawyer and have the lawyer bring the suit against the thing. And I think you can even, I don't know if other libertarians have said this explicitly, but I don't see why you wouldn't have a right to sell that kind of thing to somebody else. In other words, like some companies going around selling defective products that are blowing up and hurting people, and the people want to, you know, the actual victim, they had this product that, you know, they got home and it blew up in their face, and now they're horribly scarred or something, and they want to sue the company. And you can imagine a legal firm going around and saying, yeah, we'll bring charges against this company, but you know what? That company has a lot of money, and this is going to be tied up in court for a while, so I'll tell you what, we'll give you right now, whatever, 100 ounces of gold, and you're signing this piece of this contract with us, and you're agreeing that what we're buying from you, 100 ounces of gold, is whatever the outcome is from this legal case, we get it. So you're selling to us your legal right to compensation from this company, assuming a judge agrees that, yes, they owe you compensation. So I don't see what would be wrong with that. And then that kind of makes sense, where if there's, you know, a situation like, so that kind of, in my mind, would replace what we now think of as a class action lawsuit, where, you know, there's a company that did something that kind of caused small damages to a bunch of people, and it's not really worth it for any one person to bring suit against the big company, because first of all, the company's going to have all kinds of high-priced attorneys. And so instead, you know, they have what's called a class action lawsuit. I think the analog of that in a libertarian world would be some firm goes around and buys up all of the little dinky claims. And it could be dinky in the sense, like, if it's a case that might, it's uncertain what the outcome is going to be. You know, it's kind of thing where, yeah, that's, if the judge rules in your favor, you're going to get 100,000 ounces of gold, but we only think there's a 1% chance the judge is going to do that. And so maybe, you know, the plaintiff is willing to sell that right to the company, you know, to the law firm in exchange for 10 ounces of gold or something, because he really needs cash right away and he doesn't want to wait for 3 years. So you can imagine stuff like that. So given that principle, now you can come back to the child case and say, well, could the child, so clearly you can see there's a sense in which a person can transfer his legal rights to other people to exercise on his behalf. And so then you'd say, well, couldn't the parent then kind of, you know, be the owner of that stuff, like exercise it on behalf of the child? And so that's kind of the way things would I think build up. I mean, stuff with children is tricky, and here's how I come at it and how I would not just make, because the problem is we have a bunch of intuition. We want to be able to say, it just feels right to say, if you're a parent, you have a kid, and the kid is an infant sitting in his high chair in the kitchen, you can't just sit there and watch him starve to death and not tell anybody. But that's, surely there's got to be some kind of social sanction on that beyond just people saying, wow, that was a bad thing to do. What's wrong with you? Right? And so I think a lot of us kind of want, you know, to say, if something is going to be illegal, surely that should be illegal. And so the problem when it comes to children with this stuff is a lot of the standard libertarian approach assumes that people are responsible agents, and it rejects paternalism. You know, it says we can't assume that we know better what's right for a person. I mean, maybe we do, but legally we can't do that, and we can't make decisions for them, and we can't say, oh, you know, taking heroin is bad for you, and so we're going to make it illegal for your own good. That's anathema to most libertarians, that sort of thinking. But the one case where I think it's good to be paternalist is when you're somebody's father. You know, an actual father should be paternalistic towards his kids, at least while they're still children. I mean, that's what paternalism means. It means acting as one's parent. So it's illegitimate and a bad idea for the government, you know, people acting through the agency of the government to act as other people's parents and say, oh, no, you shouldn't smoke, and so that's why we're going to have really big taxes on cigarettes. But I don't think it's totally fine, of course, for the parents to say to their six-year-old, you can't smoke. So anyway, that's the issue with a lot of standard libertarian stuff. The reason these arguments get really, you know, make you queasy when it comes to children is I think the normal context of libertarian thought assumes that the people involved are agents who have the moral right to make their own decision. And that natural instinct is not so obvious when it comes to children, especially young children. So one last thing, I don't want to just make this whole office hours about libertarian law and child and children, but the one standard legal principle that we can all agree to that I think helps show we don't just have to make ad hoc rulings when it comes to children. In other words, I'm not just saying, well, our normal principles don't seem to work when it comes to kids, so let's throw our principles out the window. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just explaining why there is this, you know, prima facie tension, and it makes us think, oh, wait a minute, does this make sense? One principle that is standard that I think helps in these cases is you have to be of sound mind when you make a very important legal decision or a decision about your life. So, for example, the example I use a lot on these kind of issues is if you're at, you know, you're at a bar and you've been doing shots of tequila and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you're just totally wasted, and then someone takes a cocktail napkin out and puts the date at the top and says, you know, Bob Murphy agreed he's going to sell his house to meet John Smith for a bottle of beer that I'm going to give him right now. And then he draws two lines and he signs his name and there you go, Bob. And I'm still like, what, you're going to give me a bottle of beer for my house? I don't like my house anyway. I'll sign that. Give me a beer. And then the next morning, you know, when I wake up and I'm all hungover and he comes up to my house and holds up the bar napkin, you know, does he now own my house? And if, you know, and if I say, what are you kidding me? And then we go to court, even if Murray Rothbard himself, who's all about contract rights and everything, and nope, you know, if you make a decision, you got to stick by it. I'm thinking even Murray Rothbard is going to say, come on, a guy had 13 shots of tequila. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. Do you really think he understood that he was selling his house for a bottle of beer? That's crazy. That's not a valid contract. I think a lot of even hardcore libertarians would agree, I didn't sell my house to that guy for a bottle of beer because I didn't really know what I was doing. Okay, so if you at least see the plausibility of that, that's the way I think libertarian judges could handle cases with young children, where you could say, you know, someone could say, well, yeah, I punched that 1-year-old in the face, but he didn't go to a court to try to stop it. So I guess the kid, I guess he was giving me consent. So I'm going to keep punching the kid in the face. Don't get me wrong. If the kid called up a libertarian judge and asked for an injunction, well, then of course I'd have to stop. But barring that, I'm going to assume the kid's okay with me punching him in the face. You see what I'm saying? And there, I think you'd use that same principle and say the 1-year-old does not have the competence to make that decision. The 1-year-old is clueless, less, you know, more clueless than I was after 13 shots of tequila in the bar. And oh, by the same token, too, you know, if I'm out at the park and some stranger comes up to my 3-year-old and says, hey, Jimmy, how are you? And he goes, oh, I'm good. And then says, hey, you know what? I have all kinds of candy bars. How about you stop living with your daddy and you come and you'll be my kid? And then Jimmy says, oh, okay, that sounds good. I don't think the libertarian legal system is going to say, well, sorry, Bob Murphy, but your 3-year-old just agreed to now go live with this guy, and it would be aggression for you to use force to stop your 3-year-old from going where he wants to go. You know, that guy didn't grab him. That guy voluntarily persuaded your kid to go be his son from now on. And so, you know, we don't have a slave society here. You don't own your 3-year-old son. And so who are you to use force to keep him within your house? That's kidnapping. That's imprisonment. You see what I'm saying? I think, you know, even a strictly libertarian society is going to realize the 3-year-old does not have the competence to make such an important decision as to say, you know what, I'm going to go live with this person now. So that's kind of the way I don't think it would be ad hoc and arbitrary. I think the principle would be, like I said, with the guy doing tequila shots and selling his house for a bottle of beer, that the judge would just say there's certain cases where you just say, no, that's not, you know, that can't be what the person really wanted to do. And that does open Pandora's box. Because then, you know, the issue, the cases I just gave seem pretty clear cut, but there's other cases where it's not so obvious. You know, like what if someone with full legal counsel present and it was at 12 o'clock in the afternoon and they're sitting in the legal office, or, you know, sitting in the offices in a skyscraper and they're in a full suit. And, you know, that's all weeks long negotiations and they sign something. And then 2 weeks later, after the deal has been struck, they realize something like, oh, I didn't realize the implications of that contract. You know, you're not allowed to just say, well, you know what? I wouldn't have agreed to the contract if I had realized that it meant this. You know, so that kind of thing, it depends what it is. You know what I'm saying? So there are, so it's admittedly, it's a gray area. I'm just saying, I think that's what the function of having judges is, that the law by itself cannot just be interpreted blindly, that you need to have a judge who has good judgment. And that's what the function of a judge is you need to have someone with good judgment. That's what I'm saying, that I think, you know, to say the case with the guy who had 13 tequila shots, a good judge is going to say, I'm throwing that out. That's not a valid contract. Whereas in other cases, he might say, yeah, you should have thought more about that before you signed that contract. You're on the hook. Okay. I'm just looking through here. There's a lot of commentary back and forth. Okay, Matt Miller says, at Mises University, what is the difference exactly between attending as a student and attending as a member? I didn't discover Austrian economics until my late 20s, so I missed my chance to go as a student. I'd love to attend, but I'm somewhat worried I wouldn't get the full experience. No, there's no distinction in that sense. So, I mean, I think one difference is the price might be, you know, if you're going as a student, I think you don't pay anything, right? But, no, I mean, it's, there is something, like with the Rothbard Graduate Seminar, I know they were letting some people come just to observe. And so there was a distinction that the actual graduate students who were there were allowed to ask questions, and there was a lot of interaction in the Rothbard Graduate Seminar where the people who were observing were asked you know, you're kind of here literally just to observe, and we want to foster the students who are getting PhDs in economics or whatever. We want them to interact with the faculties rather than have you observers derailing the conversation. But as far as Mises University, I mean, that's the only thing I could think of, Matt. But no, if you're thinking of going and you've never been before, then by all means you should go, especially if you're in your 20s still. I mean, because there are mostly younger people there. So, I mean, somebody who's 55, it might be better for that person to go to a Mises Circle event because the crowd's going to be more similar demographically. And so the person might just feel more comfortable. But if you're still in your 20s and you've never been, yeah, you should go to Mises U. It's a blast. And, yeah, you get to go to everything. Like I said, the only possible distinction would be you might not be allowed to take the oral exam to try to compete for, you know, the prizes at the end of the week if you're not a student. That's the only thing I can think of where you would be treated differently from an official student attending. Okay. Okay, Yuri says, what should we do when we don't know which owner was the first one? Is the Austrian approach, who was first homesteader, always practical? Since we must know exactly for everyone what activity he was doing before the new neighbor came, can we now determine when he is making a harm to a newcomer? Isn't this impossible in a huge society? Well, the quick answer is I don't know. Again, that's my bad answer. I mean, I'm an economist. I'm not a lawyer or even a legal theorist per se. I guess, although I did write an essay on private law. So for people who don't know what he's talking about, the Rothbardian approach to property rights is to say, when it comes to unowned property, the first person who uses it homesteads it. And then that's how you transform unowned property into being owned. And then from that point on, then there's standard principles about how do you, you know, now what happens to that owned property title, how does it get transferred to other people? And so you're as asking, well, in certain situations, isn't it impossible to know who owned it first? Yes, but I think Rothbard just says, well, if we don't know, then the default is whoever currently owns it, right? So in other words, if somebody right now seems to be the owner of something, and that's what the law currently recognizes, it's not necessary for that person to have to prove a chain of historical events all the way back to the point at which that piece of property was unowned. Rather, what has to happen is if somebody comes along and says, hey, that person right now, the law recognizes him as the owner of that property title, but actually, you know, it was my ancestor who owned that, and then someone stole it from my ancestor, and then and so that's why it really belongs to me. Well, you've got to prove that then. And so Walter Block has a thing. If you Google Walter Block reparations, and in case you don't know how to spell that term, I'll type it out, reparations, you'll see he's got a pretty good view of that. I don't know what the claim of that is or what the status of that claim is in other countries. In the United States political context, reparations means either paying compensation to blacks who live in America because of the historical slavery or other discriminatory, racially prejudiced policies of various governments over the years in the United States. And so the idea is that black people were systematically harmed, and so now they're owed reparations. Or sometimes people might mean it for Native American Indians, who were also, I mean, quite clearly had their land stolen from them by the U.S. government. So, and so politically what happens, I mean, it's typically left-wing Democrat with a capital D groups that push this stuff, and that makes sense because those are their constituencies. Typically speaking, you know, people speaking on behalf of American blacks or Native American Indians are not right-wing conservatives who believe in small government. So because of that, a lot of people who do believe in small government or libertarians or even anti-capitalists might be skeptical of the claim for reparations, thinking, oh, that's just some liberal communist kind of thing. But Walter Block was saying, no, I mean, that's a legitimate thing from a libertarian point of view. If these people's ancestors really were, you know, captured in Africa and brought against their will over here, I mean, that's a crime, and they should be compensated. Or if the U.S. government did it, but he was saying it would be tricky in practice to prove that. He's saying, you know, it's not correct for the U.S. government today to pay compensation, let's say, to various tribes because, you know, the U.S. government 100 years ago may have killed people in those tribes or, you know, put them into reservations at gunpoint. That was admittedly a crime, but the point is right now you don't undo that crime by having the current U.S. government point guns at other people in the United States and make them pay taxes to then hand over to the great-grandchildren of the people that the old U.S. government aggressed upon, right? So that's just, but he's saying, in principle, if you could prove that, you know, hey, this guy right here is living on property, you know, land that is not, should not be his. This land belonged to this tribe, and they were displaced years ago by the U.S. government, gunpoint, and so that's their land. And yes, it's a shame if you paid money and you had nothing to do with that, and now your house happens to be on this land that technically this tribe should be the owner of, you know, that's a shame. But by the same token, look, if somebody steals my TV and then goes and sells it to somebody, and then some other person buys that TV not realizing it's stolen, under standard law, if I can prove that's my TV, then I get it back. Right? It's not that the person who bought it can say, well, sorry, I'm sorry it was stolen from you, but I had no idea, so it's mine. It's like, no, if, you know, but the problem is you really have to be able to prove it's your TV. I can't just say, hey, a year ago someone stole my TV, it looks kind of like your TV, and for all I know, that's mine. That's not enough for me to take the TV from you. So by the same token, Walter Block is saying we shouldn't dismiss reparation in principle. It's just, it'd be hard to prove that. So, but yeah, if some Native American tribe could prove that, you know, this really, this land right here is ours, well, then he's saying, you know, that under libertarian theory, that's a way you might bring it. Okay, let me just answer one more, and we'll have to cut it off here. Lewis asks, does Rothbard view the ground under which you own your property the same way he views the air when he rejects the ad coelum principle, meaning you only own what you homestead? This would then imply that underground reserves of minerals or oil are not the property of the owner of the land because he does not homestead them, and that anybody can harvest them as long as they do not infringe his property. That's a great question, and the short answer is I would want to review exactly what, I mean, the long answer is, my short answer is to say what you really ought to do to know that concretely is to read the treatment in Robert Bradley's Oil, Gas, and Government, because that's what I was telling you guys if you caught lecture one, is that that's exactly the kind of thing that Rob Bradley got into, that there's issues of, because you have two adjacent properties, and the people on the surface, and there's a guy here and a guy here, and the oil might overlap their property underground. And so if this guy drills down and taps into the oil and he starts draining the pool, and a guy over here drills down into the pool, you know, and they're both tapping into the same pool, well, then that, you know, that's an issue. And so if one guy's pumping for every barrel of oil the one guy pumps, arguably he's reducing the amount of oil that the other guy can pump. And so the question is, who gets to own it? Well, that's a tricky issue. And I'm pretty sure that Rob told me that Rothbard liked Rob's solution. That Rob, you know, having read Rothbard's general thoughts on homesteading and that kind of stuff and the ethics of liberty and whatever, Rob then, as a PhD student working on the history of government intervention in U.S. oil and gas markets, was working out this thorny issue of, in a libertarian world, how would you decide it? And I think the way Rob treated it was to say, you know, what's the proper, how should U.S. judges and regulators deal with this issue? Because it happened, and it was happening in the real world. This wasn't just some hypothetical thing. There were actual lawsuits, and the judges had to make decisions, and regulators had to come in and lay down guidelines. And so Robert Bradley was, you know, giving the history and saying, this is how they did it, and then trying to show, this is how I think it ought to be done. And off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly what Rob said. And it's, I'm guessing. I think it was something like, if one guy gets there first, he's allowed to start pumping, and then, you know, he certainly can't be blamed for doing that. But then the tricky thing was, well, what happens when the next guy taps into it too? You know what I mean? Because now you kind of get into issues of, it's not obvious. You know, like if I have an apple tree on my property, it's clearly on the side of the line in our land, and I've got an apple tree, and the wind blows some of my apples onto your ground, your grass, your backyard. Is it still my apple, or is it now your apple? You know, it's stuff like that where it's not obvious. So clearly, if I take a big net, like a little thing to clean the pool with, if I took one of those and I'm standing on my property, you know, my feet are on my side of the line, but then I lean the pole over and I go up to your apple tree and I kind of grab a few apples and then take them over, I've clearly stolen your apple. But it's not as obvious if the apples just naturally fall off your tree and then the ground is sloped and the apples kind of just roll down onto my property. So, you know, from my point of view, I just go out my back porch one day and there's apples sitting on my ground. Can I eat an apple that's on my ground? And it's even more confusing. What if I have an apple tree also? What if you and I have the same type of apple tree and then there's a windstorm or something? You know what I'm saying? And it's not obvious which tree did this come from. So that's kind of the issue with, if there's an oil deposit that's underneath both of our land, and if, you know, if I pump more, it kind of makes more of the oil flow into my side. Than so it's, I'm not giving you the answer, and I'm saying it's kind of a tricky thing. I just know Rob gave the most elaborate treatment of that in oil, gas, and government. I'm pretty sure I remember Rob telling me, show that to Rothbard. Rothbard said, yeah, that's a good job. You know, that's a good way to apply my general framework to this specific issue. So I would say, if you're really curious, go look at that. Okay, why don't I stop there, guys? And a lot of what you guys asked me this office hour is going to come up in the beginning of week three, where I'm going to go over the Rothbard reading that we didn't get to last time because I was dealing so much with Coase and Pigou. Okay, thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you guys next week.